Libya's new prime minister has visited the place where PC Yvonne Fletcher was shot dead in 1984. The shots were fired from inside the Libyan embassy, but no one has ever been charged over her murder.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So, who owns Britain these days? If you thought the medieval feudal system was over, think again. No, the feudal lords are still alive and well, and unlike the serfs, suffering austerity, they're doing very nicely, thank you. So who owns Britain? You might be quite surprised to hear our big landowning families have hardly changed since the 17th century Civil War. That's the title of a book by Southwest-based journalist Kevin Cahill, and he's here to explain why owning a semi-detached house, just enough to stop you going mad with claustrophobia, is the most we can look forward to, while the feudal landlords still have hundreds of thousands of acres they never see, let alone walk on. Also, we look at if you add up costs of material and labour to build a home, why the true cost of housing should be about £6 a week. That sounds like a bit of a racket, so why is it so much more? A nuclear clash also could starve the world. That's the message in a report released at the Nobel Peace Laureates Summit in Chicago just before NATO met there last weekend. Entitled Nuclear Famine, A Billion People at Risk, the study shows that even a limited nuclear war involving less than half of 1% of the world's nuclear arsenal would cause climate disruption that could set off a global famine. So let's start with that one, Martin Summers, as we have a little look round some of the news stories of the week. This is a little bit a great place for them to deliver this report, isn't it, as NATO are meeting. And what are your thoughts about this whole idea of having a global famine if there's even a small limited nuclear war?
Well, I should have thought it was common sense that that would be the likely outcome.
But
it's great that scientists are making these points, but nevertheless, you don't need to be a scientist to realise that a nuclear war, even a small one, would be a pretty disastrous event.
But the Americans have said that they have a plan now to deal with Iran, is a plan that possibly could turn nuclear, isn't it?
What is worrying is that the US in particular have been developing this strategic doctrine of first use of small nuclear weapons. So they've developed specific nuclear weaponry to supposedly take out Iran's nuclear facilities. And these are small 1 kiloton bombs, the size of a Hiroshima bomb. And the US military are trying to push these as usable nukes. They're not the sort of mutually assured destruction nukes which will destroy civilization. We could use these on Iran, and the effect would be, you know, marginal, and we could manage it.
So it's
if you think about the effects of Hiroshima, I doubt very much whether this would be as benign as they say.
So it's quite important for these. This is one particular one is general practitioners against nuclear war have shoved this under the noses of NATO just at the right time.
Yes, because NATO is definitely talking in terms of using small amounts of nuclear weapons. I mean, you know, the Dr. Strangeloves in the Pentagon are quite keen to use a small nuclear weapon so that they can demonstrate that they're actually family friendly, and for these people to point out that that's not good enough and it's still have a famine where 1 billion people would die is probably a useful thing for them to do.
Another story we've heard on the news just now, I'm not sure if it was in the 6 o'clock bulletin, but certainly in the 5 o'clock bulletin, is a mission being sent by Scotland Yard to reinvestigate the death of PC Yvonne Fletcher, detectives being sent over to Libya.
Yeah. Well, as you know, Tony, there was a Dispatches documentary about that murder, which came out in the 1980s. I don't think we've got we haven't got it on the internet.
1990s, actually. 1990s. Her death was in 1984, and the Dispatches documentary was shortly after. So let's have a little listen to a short clip from that documentary now.
A short clip from it, good.
Tonight on Dispatches, dramatic new evidence on one of the country's most puzzling unsolved murders. Who killed policewoman Yvonne Fletcher in London's St. James's Square? Last week, dispatches demonstrated why the official version of events, that she was shot from the Libyan embassy, could not be true. Now, to conclude this major two-part investigation, dispatches revealed just who plotted her murder and why. Tonight, reporter Joe Leyburn travels to Berlin. In this German underworld, he finds the man who knows how she was killed, and the man who brought the gun into Britain. His report raises the most profound concerns about the intelligence services in Britain and America. And tonight, dispatches join Yvonne's mother in calling for a full inquiry into murder in St. James's.
The angle of 60 to 70 degrees of entry into the body would be totally inconsistent with an angle of 15 degrees or so coming from that building. There may well have been shots fired from number 5, but you can't say that the bullet that entered her body came from that angle. It's impossible to have that occur.
Well, that's an extract from the 1996 dispatches, which apparently hasn't been seen by anybody reading out BBC bulletins today. But, Martin, the basic forensics there were carried out by the retired chief army surgeon, Lowness, who said it was actually impossible for the bullet that killed Yvonne Fletcher to have come from the Libyan embassy.
Yeah, that was the dispatches who got him involved. It wasn't an official inquiry. To give a resume of what the two programmes showed is that the bullet that killed WPC Yvonne Fletcher couldn't have come from the Libyan embassy because the angle was wrong. They also showed that the Libyan embassy was bugged, so they knew they were using certain kinds of machine guns with 9mm bullets, so that the people who did shoot her used a 9mm bullet with a gun with a silencer and shot her from an observation point which was being used by the intelligence services over the Libyan embassy. And then they traced the gun back to the underworld in Germany. And of course the suggestion in the programmes, in fact, WPC Yvonne Fletcher not killed by the Libyans at all, killed by the Western intelligence
but what
services
about the
in order to besmirch the Libyans.
But what
maybe,
about
maybe not true, but that's what the programme
says. What about the wider question that none of the coverage over the last couple of days of the resumption of this inquiry has included any of this evidence whatsoever?
Well, I think what you've got in the world is we live in a free society where journalists can make that dispatches programme that was shown in 1996, but it's never been shown again. And don't forget, hardly anybody would have watched it apart from people like ourselves who are interested in these topics, and of course Yvonne's mother, who was in the documentary. I mean, you'd have thought the BBC might have popped round to have a word with her just for a human interest angle on it, wouldn't you? But no. What tends to happen in the mainstream is everybody presumes they know what happened there. The Libyans shot her. There must be a Libyan to blame. Therefore, you know, we just go along with the general crowd on this one. And of course, the idea that the British intelligence services might go around, the American intelligence services might go around assassinating police officers, that's ludicrous, apart from people from Northern Ireland, who know better.
One of the things, well, you mentioned Northern Ireland there, but it was the Army's chief ballistics expert from Northern Ireland was also on the programme, explaining how it was impossible, really, for the shot to have come from the Libyan embassy. It came from another building.
That's the thing I remember from the programme. He was standing there, the SAS's ballistics expert, saying, well, I'll tell you one thing, it wasn't the Libyans who killed the police lady. And that's the SAS's ballistics expert saying that.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, now I'm joined by the author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill. Hi, Kevin, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. What brought you to write a book about the ownership of land in Britain?
Well, it started at the Sunday Times Rich List, where I was given the task of finding out what older money in Britain was about. Most of it's about land.
Okay, and whereabouts do you start when you go to somewhere like the Land Registry to find out who was owning the land?
The Land Registry is primeval. The Land Registry exists not to disclose land ownership or land holdings, but to conceal them. 50% of the acreage, something around 50% of the acreage of England, or England and Wales, is not in the Land Registry. So it's no good looking, therefore it's not there. And then if you went to the Land Registry, you have to know the address that you're looking for, because you can't do a kind of search saying, show me all the estates of 10,000 acres and all this sort of stuff. You can't do it.
So how does it fit in with the whole rich list business? Is land, if people own land, is that actually stuck in there as one of the aspects of someone's wealth? Is it all included?
Philip and I drew up the, they're called rules of engagement.
Sorry, who's that?
Philip Beresford is the editor of the Sunday Times Rich List, still is. He was the first one, he stayed there the whole way through. But his rules say, if we can't see your wealth, you don't go in. It's that simple. A lot of economists and others think the rich list is a cut and paste job. It isn't. Philip uses the sort of stuff that would be acceptable in a PhD, a doctorate.
But don't rich people get quite good at hiding their wealth? If you say,
yeah, I mean there are a number of rich people who aren't in the rich list because they put their money offshore or something.
Okay.
So they're not in the list.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? There are quite some limitations to what the rich list even is able to do.
The rich list is the most significant social document about wealth ever produced.
Okay, so
sorry about that, but it is
okay. Yes, but it's even
beats the Doomsday Book into a cocktail.
Which Doomsday?
But even so, I mean, even that has its limitations. So you in 2002, you wrote Who Owns Britain. Can you just tell us about how that's laid out? And one thing I love about it is you can open this book on any county in Britain and you get a bit of a potted history of who's owned the land over the last several hundred years and how it's changed.
Yeah, you can do that because it took me 13 years to write it. As I've just said, the land registry is hopeless, totally useless. Even if you could, the land registry were quite helpful in the beginning. They wanted to see if they could give me a hand. And they said, we've got an estate in Essex, which is actually fully registered. And you could look at that. It's 4,000 acres. There were 840 registrations at £7.20 a toss. In other words, it's impossible. So their goodwill didn't go anywhere because they couldn't. But the land registry is constructed to conceal land ownership.
So the only way you can actually find out who owns land is if you actually got a specific geographical point, you can find out, possibly, fingers crossed, who owns it. And it may be that nobody has ever registered that land, is that right?
50% of the acreage is probably not registered.
And that's because it simply hasn't changed hands?
It's never changed hands since the Land Registration Acts of 1925.
Now, not long after you brought the book out in 2002, there was a programme called Whose Britain Is It Anyway? Done by Peter Snow and the BBC. Just tell us your experiences of that, because you were a consultant, I believe, on that programme.
A consultant who was never actually consulted. Consequently, the most crucial point about land ownership, that the Crown actually owns all physical land, wasn't mentioned in the programme.
So hang on a minute. What about my freehold of my semi-detached house?
Your freehold is actually a lease from the Crown.
No. If it's a freehold, it can't be. That's a leasehold. Is something different.
In law, your freehold is a lease. It's a medieval lease. And the difference between that and, say, you know, a lease for 30 years is that the freehold lease is indefinite, but it's not about the ground your house is built on or anything. You have an interest in an estate in land. The Crown owns the land. You have an interest.
Now, is that in the small print, in the deeds of the house?
Most solicitors know this, but they don't tell anybody.
Okay, so but they didn't mention that in the programme, even though that's quite an important point. So that's about all.
It was sort of basic.
It is, isn't it? Fundamental. And this is all of the land in England and Wales and Scotland?
Yeah, the Crown owns, with one, and it's worth making a point. Throughout the book, I say the Crown owns all land, but actually, there's one exception. It's Cornwall. The Crown, as the Queen, does not own Cornwall. The Duke of Cornwall does. So there are two feudal superior owners of the physical land in the United Kingdom.
So you say the Duke of Cornwall. I'm getting a bit confused. Is that the Duchy of Cornwall? Is that the same as Prince Charles?
No, there's a difference. The Duchy is a sort of estate with acreage here in Bristol and down in Taunton and all around.
That's right. We've got little villages, haven't we, owned by the Duchy?
Yeah. No, in Cornwall, he is the feudal superior. The county of Cornwall is owned, all the land in Cornwall, by Prince Charles.
Okay. What about some of the big institutional landowners, though? Because this must have been one of the first things that you could sort of drill down into. I'm talking about things like the Forestry Commission and possibly the Ministry of Defence. How much land do they own?
Well, if you look in our neighbouring, in a county right on your doorstep, if you look at Wiltshire, the Ministry of Defence have 107,000 acres, which is a huge amount of land. Wiltshire is a county of only 800,000 acres, and the Ministry of Defence holds 10%, more than 10%, about 12% of it. Wiltshire is exceptional because of the artillery ranges and the tank training areas and so on. But the biggest holder of land from the Crown is the Forestry Commission. And the Forestry Commission is actually owned by the government.
Okay, and all of this, is it still the same, within the same situation where all of the freeholds of these pieces of land are actually owned by, it's land actually fundamentally owned by the Queen? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, that's what about the Church of England? Many people think that they're big owners.
No, there is a terribly serious question about the Church of England. In 1872, the Church of England had 2.2 million acres, which, like, 2.5 counties, make it simple. And in 2001, they had 100,000 acres. It was down 2.1 million acres. The land of the Church of England was actually the glebe land in each parish.
Now, what is glebe land then?
It was the land given to the Church of England and its clergy by Henry VIII, so they could make a living.
That was after the dissolution of the monasteries?
After the dissolution of the monasteries. A percentage of the monastic land was given to the new church, because the obvious assumption by Henry was that the parishioners weren't going to pay enough money for the priest to live, so each parish was given a lump of land and to live off of. And but that was inalienable in law. So the process by which 2.1 million acres was disposed of has never been explained by the Church of England.
Right, so the Church of England shouldn't have actually sold it, and they weren't actually legally allowed to sell it, but somehow they have.
On the face of it, they were not legally allowed to, but within that, there were various processes. But if those processes were used, the Church to this day has failed to explain how they were used, why they were used, and why 2.1 million acres is no longer there.
Okay, let's talk about some of the real fundamentals then. How much land is there in Britain? How many acres roughly? And I always try and do this thing where you figure out how many people there are and how many acres of land there are.
There's 60 million acres and there are about 62 million people.
So where's my acre? Where's my acre? I suppose there's
it's just the urban population seem to be able to survive on about a tenth of an acre. Only 10% of, we ought to get to this, only 10% of the United Kingdom is urban, covered by bricks and mortar, and it's actually less than that. But London distorts the statistics and the areas around it. So 90% of the United Kingdom is not urban, not roads, and it's
agricultural.
Yeah, agriculture, mountains, bogs, so on.
Okay, so a handful of people surely own most of this land. Have you worked out what proportion own how much of this 60 million acres?
It's relatively simple. You can do it through the worst set of statistics on the planet, which are the MAF statistics for agriculture. The agricultural plot is about 71% of the United Kingdom. It's about 41 million acres, something like that. And out of the 60 million... 159,000 families own those 41 million acres.
Okay, so what's that roughly as a proportion? I mean, we can sit and work it out if you want.
71% of the island is of the island in Northern Ireland is owned by 159,000 families.
Okay. Now, also, how much has ownership changed? I mean, obviously, we had the Norman invasion in 1066, we had the Civil War, big upheavals in the 17th century. How much has it changed over the last several hundred years?
England's been subject to four really massive changes. The process behind those changes has never been explained by historians. They've completely failed to explain that, starting with William the Conqueror, who said he owned it all, English history has an underlying thing, an effect, where the barons then spent the rest of history trying to take all the land off the crown, and they succeeded. By 1872, apart from the underlying claim, the crown had was down to, I forgot what it's in the book, about 28,000 acres, and the barons had the rest. So the battle, the hidden battle that went on for 800 years in the United Kingdom was won by the barons. They wound up in 1872, they, their families and their cousins, owning about 90% of the country.
This date of 1872, it pops up in your book quite a bit. Is that one of the sort of baselines of where we do know who owned the land at that point? Was there a survey done or something?
Yeah. It's a great start line to a conversation. You can say to almost anybody, you know, you've heard of Doomsday, and everybody says, yeah, and they're talking about 1086. And you say, what about the second one? And everybody goes blank. What second Doomsday? The first Doomsday, which wasn't the land registry and isn't a unique historic document in generically, was a pretty cack-handed survey of 35 of the 44 English counties. It didn't stretch to Wales or Scotland or Ireland anywhere. And it was really a swag list. It was William's list of the things he could levy taxes on. And it's a very common document in history. Every tin pot dictator through history had his doomsday
swag list.
it's
an inventory, really.
In William's case, though, it was a thieves' inventory, because he had actually stolen under the laws of the time. You know, we shouldn't go on, but according to the laws of the time, his usurpation of the British, of the English crown, and grabbing of the land was illegal at the time.
Now, I know throughout the country he sent commissioners out, didn't he? And there were actually, in some parts of the country, riots where the commissioners turned up saying, we want to know what everyone's got here so we can tax it. And they were told where to go. And so the soldiers had to come and actually help them figure out. This is going back a long, long time. But, you know, do you think there's still some sort of significance today for what happened in Doomsday in 1066? Is that what you're saying?
And you know one of the estates extremely well around here, the Beaufort estate. The Duke of Beaufort's estate goes back to Doomsday.
That's Badminton, isn't it? Just north of Bristol, yeah.
So there are a few, but they're not a lot. But the pattern of estates started to come into being in 1086, or with the conquest. But by the middle of the 1100s, that the pattern and scale and nature of English estates had been fixed, more or less.
Okay,
could we go to the second Doomsday? It's
extremely important. Yeah, of course. Yeah, go for it. Yeah, yeah.
Unlike the first Doomsday, which crops up as far back as 2030 BC, documents like it, the Egyptian pharaohs had Doomsdays. The second Doomsday, there are very few documents, if any, meaning I've never been able to find one like it, where there was a total survey of every ownership, of every holdership, in four countries in one go. The whole of the United Kingdom as it then was, which was England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland, was surveyed on the orders of the government, and a printed volume, a big printed book of all these owners, as they were called, and this is an extremely important point, they were called owners. And all the literature, the legal literature, the historic literature and everything is full of, you know, the crown and your lease and your freehold and all this sort of stuff from the crown. This massive government survey called itself the Return of Owners of Land. It was an attempt by the aristocracy to finally extinguish the crown's grip on land altogether. And you say, well, why would they do that? And the answer was, they actually held 90% of it. And if this had succeeded, the holders would have become owners. And the majority of the holders were aristocrats who had been, if you like, for 800 years trying to nick all the land the crown had.
Well, I'll just be doing a few calculations while you've been talking there about your number of people, how many people own how much land, and it comes out at 0.2%, that is your 159,000, owning 60% of the land. That's not really...
No, 71%.
71% of the land, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, so that does tell us a lot about the imbalance, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, for many people... You think, well, the feudal days are gone. Actually, we're living in a merchant economy.
No,
now.
We're not. We're living in a feudal state in relation to land.
But what about money? I mean, people have got money. They don't really need land, do they? They can go to the supermarket, they can buy their food, they can put petrol in the car. So why do they need land?
Well, 65% of families in the country have a stake in their home. You know, they're either the head of the household owns it or the partners in the relationship, whatever. We build houses that are about half the size of houses in Europe. So our houses are very small. The second thing is we're actually building blocks of flats in rural areas where there's buckets of land, but you can't find out because the land registry doesn't function. So local people who might wonder why they're building, you know, a block of flats in a village somewhere instead of, say, even a row of houses with some garden... What most people want is, you know, there was a survey about 20 years ago. What everybody wants is a detached house with half an acre and a view of the sea. It's not totally realistic. We'd have a strip of housing all along the coast, so it's not realistic. Most people actually faced with, say, half an acre won't take it on. It's hard work. My wife looks after an acre, and it's probably 60 hours a week to do it properly and grow real food that you actually use. So it's an awful lot of our urban population do not want half an acre.
Well, one of the things that happens a lot in the continent, Kevin, isn't it, that people keep animals. You know, they actually, if you go into Belgium, for example, in a Belgian town, you'll find sometimes chickens, you know, this kind of thing. And I guess we used to do that in days gone by.
Yeah, and during the war, everybody, during the Second World War, enormous number of people kept chickens and pigs quite literally in the backyard. But the key issue is, because of the way land is held as a monopoly by a very small group and the inadequacies of the land registry, we have houses that are far too small, and we also have a little bit of greenery with houses, at least to the extent, you know, that it's provided for people who want it.
I mean, is there any reason why people can't just go and get an allotment, for example?
No, there's a huge queue for allotments. I don't know what it is, but allotments have really come back. All the allotments in Exeter, where I live, are thriving, and they're busy, and they're full of people growing things, because there's a queue, big queue. And allotments are usually sort of quite small, about less than a tenth of an acre or less, and that's what people can cope with. When it starts getting bigger, it starts becoming hard work.
Okay, we're going to have a bit of Woody Guthrie in a minute, but before we do, tell us about some of these other big institutional-type landowners. The Duchy of Lancaster, the Duchy of Cornwall, we've already mentioned, but what about the Duke of Westminster, the Duke of Buccleuch, and also the Guinness Trust are big landowners?
Yeah, the biggest, the one who claims to be the biggest private landowner in Europe was the late Duke of Buccleuch. He wasn't. There are bigger landowners than him, but he had over a quarter of a million acres and was very proud of it. And but what he doesn't talk much about is the urban land, which is where the real wealth of the Buccleuch estate is. The Buccleuch estate owns land in urban areas, and it's the same with a lot of the big estates. I mean, take Grosvenor. He's got loads of...
That's the Duke of Westminster,
Duke of Westminster. He's got 100,000 acres in Scotland. He's got thousands of acres in Cheshire. But it's the 300 acres in London that create this huge, huge value.
Now, we're talking about places like... This is on the Monopoly Board, Mayfair, Park Lane.
Mayfair and Belgravia. The best, the priciest places in London.
Now, the thing is, it does sound a little bit unfair for someone to own a big chunk of land like that, because really he doesn't actually do anything, does he? But he gets a massive, massive income from
it. History isn't fair.
So
there's the simple thing. History is profoundly unfair.
And at some point in some time over history, someone has fought someone for that land. They've got that land, and it just so happens to be in a fantastic place.
No, if you want to find who fought who for what in the Grosvenor Estate, you probably have to go back to the conquest.
This is the Normans.
Yeah, because after that, the way most families acquired estates or expanded them was by marriage.
Well, I'm joined by Kevin Cahill, the author of Who Owns Britain, and also another sequel to that, and Who Owns the World. But Who Owns Britain apparently is coming out again, a second edition of it later in the year. But before we resume our chat with Kevin, let's have Woody Guthrie and kind of the obvious song, really, for tonight.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting, and the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me.
That was Woody Guthrie there with This Land Is Our Land. I'm joined by Kevin Cahill, the author of Who Owns Britain. Now, Kevin, the other aspect to all of this is we hear about something called common land. Does that come into your survey at all?
Not much, because there's not much of it in England in particular anymore. There's more of it in Scotland, and Andy Whiteman has done terrific work on it. It works better. In the modern world, it's very hard to make common land work on a practical basis. In Scotland, however, with the crofts, where the crofting is legally protected and everything, yes, common land has a meaning.
So what is common land? What is it?
It means land. Now, it means land where more than one party had rights of use. Yeah, it might have been owned or held by a feudal tenant, you know, one of the great landowners or something, but until the enclosures, that the common rights were accepted by the holders, if you like, the owners, and, you know, the villagers would be allowed to graze their pigs or whatever it was.
So we were talking about a system where the landholders were actually big sort of institutional landlords, and they would cover many, many, many acres, and then lots and lots of people would be living there and have rights to stay and there, and to do all sorts of things like grow food, to gather wood, all this kind of thing.
You know, graze animals. That was probably the most important aspect, grazing animals, rather than the others. But during the 17th and particularly 18th century, the owners, who all occupied both the House of Lords and the House of Commons, moved to, you know, cancel, extinguish those rights to graze and all the other rights.
So this is what we commonly known as enclosure.
That's
enclosure. Can you just take us through what that would have meant to a particular, you know, to any village? You know, say, I know when an enclosure of a village was proposed, someone would come down from Parliament, from a legal firm or whatever, and nail an enclosure order onto the door of the local parish church, and this sometimes caused a riot all on its own.
Yeah,
you know, with some occasions where it's mentioned that even though the person had arrived at dawn, by the time they'd been spotted, there was a massive crowd stopping them actually getting to the church door to nail the enclosure orders there.
But the reaction was there was no consultation. Remember that, and Parliament did not represent the people. In those days, Parliament represented the landowners, and there is no, in the end, none of the protests were effective. The enclosures went ahead in one particular period, I can't remember the dates, but 8 million acres of England, England's only 30 million acres, you're talking about very close to a third, was enclosed.
Well, we think about things like privatisation of the National Health Service now. This was a much more fundamental privatisation.
If you couldn't graze your animals or pick up your wood to keep you warm in the winter, you were dead. But the reason that we were discussing this the other day, the reason there wasn't or there weren't any wide-scale riots is because, A, the Industrial Revolution was occurring and people could go into the cities and earn a living. And the second thing, which has never been properly studied, was the pressure was taken off by the colonies. The Grosvenor estate, just one example, lots and lots of them did it, but the Grosvenor estate set up a huge colony in South Africa, the Orange River colony, with the surplus peasants from their estates in Chester. So the social pressure that might have led to rebellion was eased off by these two effects, the cities, the factories, and the colonies.
If I could just bring you in, Martin Summers, this whole, isn't it, are we sort of facing a bit of a denouement here? Because we're now in a situation where literally the country is slowly being deindustrialised, and all of those jobs that were available for people during the Industrial Revolution, Britain was the first country in the world really to go for mass urbanisation back when these enclosures were happening. We're now facing a situation where, although we've taken people out of the countryside, there simply aren't going to be those industrial jobs there for them at all anymore.
Well, that's true. I mean, even at the time of industrialisation, the economist David Ricardo, and he was representing, if you like, the sort of mercantile interest, and I remember reading his stuff, and of course it's there in Marx as well. He pointed out, look, a manufacturer actually does something. You know, he organises production, he decides what to produce, he employs people. People who own land get what's called economic rent, and most of the value of land depends upon activity that goes on around it. The 300 acres in the centre of London is worth so much because of all the activity that goes on around it. It's the location that makes it worth so much money. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing that Grosvenor does actually contributes to that. The money that they may do some manufacturing or entrepreneurial activities with their land, but the actual ownership of the land gives them an income stream. And of course, people like Henry George put the argument for, well, that actually is actually the community's dividend, which has been purloined and taken by this tiny minority who don't physically actually do anything, unlike manufacturers, for example.
Can I come in on something? Yeah. Because there has been a transformation that no economist has addressed. It's really, well, it's a combination. In 1872, 4.5% of the population owned everything. Mm-hmm. The other 95% owned nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's changed. Right now, 65% of the population have a stake in land. And that is extremely important politically and economically. And nobody's addressed it.
Well, I think it makes a difference. You were talking earlier why there haven't been revolutions and so on. It's because the system ultimately has got some flexibility in it. I mean, the whole thing of giving people, mortgage tax relief in order to encourage them to buy houses as opposed to rent houses. I mean, that's a very British thing. In other parts of Europe, people don't get mortgage tax relief on buying houses. They rent houses, even quite wealthy people.
No, but you've got to ask yourself the key question. Why do people want to buy, say, rather than rent? And the answer is really simple. The freehold lease gives you the highest level of available security for your home, you know, where you bring your family up, in a modern world. It doesn't give you perfect protection, but it gives you a higher degree than any other system, especially the rented system.
Oh yeah, well, and of course, if you're buying your own house on a mortgage, you're unlikely to go on strike because you could be immediately evicted. Whereas if you are in council house, you can just run up your rent arrears and so on. I mean, there was the political reason for encouraging housing, building societies and the encouragement of working class, if you like, or middle class home ownership was to stabilise the social system, give everybody a stake. But yep. Of course, people who are buying their own houses now, you say they've got a stake, but actually it's the bank or the mortgage company that owns your little castle. And well, if you don't keep up the payments, they will take it off you.
Yeah, that needs modification. About 20%, possibly a good bit higher, of all the domestic dwellings are actually don't have a mortgage.
No, they're already bought out. Right?
They're bought out. So, but it's the change from having nothing to having something. And it's never been properly looked at.
But Kevin, still, the majority of people out there don't actually have that, actually own their own property. They're either paying off a mortgage or they're renting, or else they're homeless. There's still quite a lot of people
I want you to grapple with this. The majority of the population, 65%, are not in the homeless situation. It's a different situation. The majority, 65%, 25% of the 65% own the house outright. The others are in the process of getting it. And I think it's an ideological misstatement to talk about the banks or the building societies owning the house, because the people in the house don't feel that, mostly. They feel they're in a process which will deliver them the house at the end of the process.
So long as they behave themselves.
So long as the economy doesn't collapse,
And this is where the protection offered to homeowners in the system is crude, cruel, and unfair. They paid their taxes, so when the jobs go, they're entitled to the same as a council tenant, you know, unemployment. And
now, I did just bring them up just now, but you mentioned this sort of proportion of people who are owners of nothing at all in your gazetteer in Who Owns Britain. Who can you be a citizen of a country and be actually own nothing and have no real security over where you're going to stay for the next, you know, if you could be wiped out in a month's time?
Well, no, again, if you press the figure, you get a false impression. I didn't refine the figure. I allowed, say, that most domestic dwellings are owned by a partnership, the husband and the wife, and that anybody who wasn't husband or wife didn't really have a stake, although I separately said they do, because they do. They'll inherit it or something else. And it's funny when people say, you know, the bank owns your house, really. Most people buying a house don't see it that way.
No, well, yeah, okay. What about these gypsies, the tinkers, the travellers and itinerant workers? I mean, this is a massive part of history, and yet now, since things like the Criminal Justice Act, there is really very, very little. Yeah. And we've now got the criminalisation of squatting. So this is putting the squeeze on to the homeless and the bottom end, I suppose, what you say, of the rented sector, people that aren't actually able to stay in their home for very long.
Yeah. No, there's a dilemma. You know, do you proceed and try and get everybody to buy a house? And you'll find, I say in the book, that most societies need a rented sector, probably of at least 10%, to give people who don't want to own a home, whatever. Currently, it's split almost evenly between housing associations, private landlords, and council. There's too little, probably, of all three at the moment. But, if you like, the people who should have been looking at these issues and the impact and everything else, the economy, haven't done it. There's just no real workable studies on it.
But what you've got in Britain is this whole idea of home ownership being a kind of, it's a shibboleth, really. And of course, if you don't build council houses, or we haven't done for a generation, that allows property bubbles to develop. when people really had an option. I mean, my family was a bit split. One half of them lived in council houses. The other half bought their own. The posher half bought their own houses. But a council house was a perfectly legitimate way for people to get a decent house.
The other thing, of course, is
meant that the house prices were not that.
The other thing, of course, is about the council housing and the housing associations. Is up until now, anyway, there's been very good security of tenure for these aspects. And isn't this really what everybody needs, Kevin? Is they need to be told that you can stay there, you're not going to be locked out in a month's time.
This is the statement, you know, that the freehold gives you the highest level, it doesn't give you perfection, but it gives you the highest and best chance. But a vibrant council section is incredibly important in the kind of society we've got. And again, the economists failed when Thatcher said...
But why is it so important?
Well, it stops property bubbles. If you stabilise, prices in Germany have bumped along at the same price for 40 years. Yeah. So everybody knows where they stand. They all know how much it costs to buy a house or to rent a house. There's not much difference in it. And what you've got in Britain is you get these bubbles where people get on the ladder. I mean, when I lived in Fulham, people wrote to the local place, I got more money from my house rising in value this year than I got from going out to work. And I work in the city. This is not rational. It's not rational.
It's
silly.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The real cost of housing should be £6 a week. Now that's that sounds like a controversial statement, but this is really, if you take out the actual cost of the land, you're looking at the cost of the materials and labour at £10 an hour to build a 6-bedroom house. And this is a little analysis by a builder that I saw online. He's involved in the business, but he's very frustrated and annoyed by the fact that housing costs such a lot of money. To give an example of how banking taxes and interest charges, the charging of interest, actually this is a simplified look at how much our homes should cost. Three bricklayers working 40 hours a week for 3 weeks to build in brick and block a 6-bedroom house, then carpentry first and second fix, two men working 40 hours a week for 3 weeks, that's 240 hours, and then as it's a new build, plumbing and electrics, four men working 1 week for 40 hours, that's 160 hours, the roof tiles, the felt and lath, two men working an 8-hour day, working for 2 days, that's 32 hours. Put that all together, and you get roughly 800 man-hours of labour, plus that's 19 weeks at 40 hours for the actual building, applying the same principles to the materials with modern technology, takes 708 hours, so that's add the two together, you get 1,500 man-hours total to build a 6-bedroom house. And if you work out how much you'll be repaying a loan of £15,000, because that's what it is, that value, over 50 years, that's about £6 a week. So there's all sorts of people taking at various points, and we're paying way, way more than £6 a week, for our housing.
He didn't fix on the key figure, the cost of the land. That's 60% of the cost of a house. So to explain, you know, the figures like that to ordinary people, you say, well, you start with an overhead. The land on which the plot is totally overvalued by the false scarcity created by a land registry that doesn't work, created by all these secret monopolies, you know, the big estates and et cetera, et cetera. And so you have an irrational market and an unregulated market as well.
Now, do you think that there are better ways of doing this, Kevin? Have you thought about, you know, what might be a better system?
Well, no, I mean, my idea of a better system would be what Martin has said, the German system of stable framework if you want to own a home.
And do you think that
there isn't a better system?
Do you think people should have actually a right to a home? I mean, we're now talking about a situation where people who don't have a home are being made criminals. We've got the rather nasty situation looming of private prisons too, where there's actually a financial incentive to be criminalising people.
I think that there's a dilemma, and you do need to face up to it. The real counter pressure, squatting has been going on for ages, and nobody minded very much as long as the squatting was done on the rich. You know, but when squatters started to move into middle class housing and middle class homes, then it became an issue. And of course, the state moved to protect the bulk of the democracy. So squatting is a really tricky one, because if anybody can go and squat in your house, What security have you got?
Well, you don't. I mean, currently, if that happens, then, first of all, it's very easy to get the police involved straight away if you're actually living there. I mean, for the most part, squatters will be squatting places which have been empty for at least several months.
No. The principle is crucial. Forget the detail. Go to the principle. If we are a property-owning democracy and 65% of the population have a stake and have chosen that path, they've made the decision. You know, they didn't vote for it. They just voted for it with their wallet. They choose this path. You can't have people breaking in your house when you've gone away for the weekend.
What about commercial property? I mean, this is what's happening now.
What is actually publicly owned buildings which have not been used? I used to squat in Brixton, and we squatted in the Loughborough estate, where in actual fact it was full of asbestos, so they couldn't move families in for health reasons, but there were loads of empty flats, so we used to squat them. And because they would have been empty otherwise, and that becomes tolerated.
You're talking to a couple of squatters here, Kevin.
Squatting's been going back for a very long time. For hundreds of years, people used to squat in the forest lands and so on.
Yeah. Can I just say, Kevin? When I was squatting, it was a housing association place where the housing association was going through all sorts of financial difficulties and had completely lost the plot when it came to its actual properties.
But listen, do you know what you're doing, Tony? How the monopolies defeat the people who want to really know what's going on and come up with a different solution is they bog you down in detail and specific cases. Oh, you know, my son squatted and he got picked up at the police and all this sort of thing. You have to go for the principle or you get lost.
Well, what is the principle there?
The principle is, if we've chosen to be a homeowning democracy, then there has to be absolute protection for your house. It's that simple.
And everyone has to have one,
but
surely.
I would say from a political point of
and
view.
Can we just get to this, Martin? Yeah. Because, you know, the idea here being really that, you know, if you're a citizen of a country, if you're part of this land where we are now, then you need to have a little slice of it. How do we get to that position?
But in the book, I believe it's a fundamental human right to have a proper, you know, a place you can bring your family up in. You know, a proper home, shelter.
So how do we get from here to there?
Well, there's one awful answer, you might like it, but we get from here to there by giving everybody who hasn't got a house the opportunity to buy one. But not, you know.
But this is where the economics kicks in. If you've got an unequal income distribution, because we've got a free market economy where we allow a big unequal distribution, and in actual fact, the bottom third of the population simply don't have. If you're going to have a low level of wages, which the bosses want, and so on, they just haven't got the money to buy houses. No. Therefore, they have to be provided.
But Martin, you're driving at it. If the infrastructure is failing, you're never going to get there.
Of course not.
Even to the point of saying, well, not everybody. Some people want to rent, and there should be a rented sector, and council housing is important. But if the infrastructure, and this is the real issue, is failing to create jobs, failing to create employment, etc., you can't do this. You can't create a situation.
Also, the subprime mortgage crisis in the US, where they tried to make everybody buy a house. Now, those people were too poor to buy a house. I mean, mortgages in the old days were quite difficult to get. You had to be in the queue. Yeah. You had to join a building society.
Well, they're difficult for years, Martin.
And they're difficult allow you to get a mortgage.
They're difficult to get now, actually.
Well, because what happens is they hand them all like sweeties, and then it all crashes, and then everybody's left with. I mean, in the US, people, there's literally houses being left empty as they walk away. They're just left empty.
But there are whole estates in the US with empty houses boarded up.
When we bought our first house, the cost of the plot, the cost of the site, was about 25% of the house. It's now 60%. So you can see where the crunch actually came.
Okay, Kevin, now we're getting towards the end, so could you just tell us, you're apparently updating this with another journalist, putting together a new version of this for later in the publication later in the year. And I'm glad to see, because if you're trying to get a hold of a second-hand copy of Who Owns Britain, you could be talking about paying £60-70 for it. So tell us about your new up-and-coming edition.
There were two problems with the first book. The first was just getting the figures. 13 years. But the second problem was I did it by myself. There's no real, it's come up in our conversation, there's no real theory in this book about anything. It's just the first attempt to say, here are the actual figures. Now, guys, come on, let's start thinking about what they mean. The figures we're going to come up with in the new edition will be much, much better. And you will find that me and my colleague are much sharper.
So who are you working with?
She's a journalist called Fiona O'Clery.
And when can we expect the new edition out?
October, November.
Okay, I'm just going to just like you to round up, Kevin. By I mean you've done an incredible job, I think, in putting this, particularly putting this little gazette here together. But by just reminding of us of how you think we should be looking at getting from a situation where we have so many people now who literally don't have a stake to the situation which you believe is everyone's human right. To have a home.
Have a proper home. Well, the first thing, and Martin touched on it again and again, is jobs. If you can't create jobs, you can't proceed on the path that 65% of the population have chosen, and the other 35% are out for good. So creating the opportunity for those amongst the 35% who want to get the securest form of domestic, you know, security is pretty well dead. It's a catastrophe, and the job thing is going to get worse.
But do you want to chip in, Martin? How are we going to get some jobs going?
I suggest that we build some council houses and create some jobs building the council houses, then put people in those houses, and there should be a balance in the sector. There should be private ownership by all means, but there should be social ownership and also state ownership, if you like. And I think that a balanced system, that's how they've managed it in Germany. Yeah. They have a balanced system. Because it's with different strokes for different folks. People who are cleaners can't afford to buy six-bedroom mansions.
Yeah.
But they should still have a decent home, shouldn't they?
They should have a chance to get some kind of home.
That and it doesn't necessarily have to be owned. It could be rented, but they need secure tenancy.
But do you know, there was another thing that nobody seems to have noticed, and again, it's critical. For the first time in history, all of history, a very big lump of the population own an asset. It's never happened before.
Yeah, but then that can lead to collective selfishness. I'm all right, Jack, pull up the ladder.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much. And thank you, Kevin, very much for joining us this evening. That's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night, 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Green Party councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt. Also to journalist you just heard there, and author of Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World? We didn't even go there, Kevin Carhill, and to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, Operation Paperclip and the Nazi capital flight scandal. Why did the Allies allow billions of dollars worth of Nazi loot to be smuggled out of Germany in the closing months of World War II? And where did it all end up? Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, this week, .org.uk takes us straight to this show and our archives, plus links every evening, put up every Friday evening, to items on this programme. That's thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.